This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guests this morning are Bernard Leotauer and Jackie Dunn. Bernard has been a leader in the field of money for more than 30 years and is a co-designer of the European Currency Unit, the precursor to the euro. He is currently a research fellow at the Center for Sustainable Resource Development at the University of California, Berkeley. Jackie is an award-winning journalist and founder of Dana Resources, an emerging leader in helping entrepreneurs develop technologies and initiatives that restore the Earth. Bernard Leotauer and Jackie Dunn are here to tell us about their book, Rethinking Money: How New Currencies Turn Scarcity into Prosperity, published in 2013. Welcome to you both.
Thank
you. Good morning.
What led you to write your book? What is your goal?
The book really came out of various conversations I've been having with Bernard over a dozen years, and really inspired by very ordinary people like our listeners, getting together within their community and rethinking money.
What is money? What are the key features of our current monetary system?
Well, most textbooks and all textbooks in economics actually always define money as medium of exchange, standard of value, and store of value. However, that is not what money is. That's what money does. These are the functions of money. The real definition of money is it's an agreement within a community to use something standardized as a medium of exchange. Now, that can be a neighborhood, it can be a country, it can be the world.
Would you elaborate on how our current monetary system doesn't serve us well?
Well, look at everything that doesn't happen. Think of all the projects that we all believe should have happened and don't happen. And invariably, the same excuse is used. There's not enough money to do this. Our budgets are tight. It is generally assumed that the money is value neutral, that it's just a passive medium of exchange that doesn't affect neither the relationship with the users nor any of the decisions on how to use that currency. That's not true. All our money today is created with bank debt and therefore has interest built in. Now, there are a series of consequences of that. The first one is that it's a competitive tool. People compete for money. And the reason is that when money is created, only the principal is created, the interest we have to extract from each other. So there's always an undertow of competition. The second aspect is that it makes short-term thinking the logical way of looking at the world, which is not what we need today. Finally, it concentrates resources at the top. And that's why it has propelled the industrial age. The industrial age required such concentration. I don't think we need that anymore at the same extent in the future.
And I'd just like to underscore something that Bernard just said. You know, bankruptcy, which people go through an awful lot of shame and angst over, is actually part and parcel of this system. They never create the interest on a loan. We've got to go out and compete with one another in order to bring that back as interest payments on our loans, be it for a car or a house or whatever. And there isn't sufficient money in the system. We compete with another and people go bankrupt as a result. It's one of the great flaws of the system that people have to go bankrupt.
In your book, you talk about redesigning money or complementary currencies. What are complementary currencies?
So when you start talking about complementary currencies or redesigning money or rethinking money, people's eyes glaze over and they think, oh, good Lord, we're into the deep dungeons of economics and I can't possibly get my mind around it. But in fact, most people listening to your broadcast today actually use complementary currencies. Think about it. Frequent flyer miles. These are currencies that started off as a loyalty program back 40 years ago in order to get people to become loyal to one particular airline, such as American Airlines. But when you think about it, frequent flyer miles can be used to purchase all kinds of things, not only your next seat to Cancun for vacation. You can rent a car, you can have hotel nights. But what's really interesting about the frequent flyer program is there are now billions and billions of frequent flyer miles processed every single day. And it is possible very cheaply to process these units of account. And they change behavior by getting people to be loyal to an airline. So what we're talking about, imagine if we took this technology, and as many communities are already doing, and doing something of greater social purpose than just a loyalty gimmick.
So what would be a complementary currency that could be used for a social purpose?
So maybe I can give an example of a complementary currency in action. You know, Aging is a huge problem in all our countries. Japan really hit the wall about 20 years ago and decided to do something about its graying population. So they set up a complimentary currency called furiakipu, which literally means caring friendship tickets, whereby I go down the street and I take care of a neighbor by helping her go shopping. I may drive her to the doctor or to the dentist. And for every hour that I do something to help her, I get an electronic credit in my furiakipu account, which I can keep when I've got the flu or when I'm older and actually need help myself. What's interesting about this particular system in Japan is I can transfer them to my mom or a member of my family that lives in another part of the country, and somebody can come in and look after her. What's really, really vital and what's really exciting about this project is that the elderly can actually stay in their own homes for much longer without having to be institutionalized. It's not costing the government anything. And when asked, the elderly people say how much they enjoy this system because neighbors are calling in and intergenerational friendships are growing out of this program. And that's something we suffer from tremendously in this society, is that we're all being siloed, you know, given our various age groups. You know, there's very little interaction between elderly and, say, the much younger. So there are about 500 of these programs all over Japan, and there are two central clearinghouses that keep track of all the furiakipu accounts. This in America is known as time banking, which is perhaps the largest system here in the United States, with about 400 programs dotted all through the country. And it's become so popular, they're growing by 1 to 2 new programs every single week.
What key design features are needed for new currencies? You've mentioned a few examples, but looking at the whole, what are the key elements?
The first thing, what's the purpose? Jackie has just described one Japanese system, which is has a social purpose one. Let me give you another example to give you the breadth of this thing. The consequences of short-term thinking has become very obvious. And the businesses that are deciding our future are only taking into account the next few quarters, really, in terms of their impact on their balance sheet. So we have a proposal for a currency, which is a global currency, that's nobody's national currency, whose purpose specifically is to reprogram businesses, large multinationals, to think long-term. It becomes profitable to think long-term in such a system. It's called the Terra, or the trade reference currency. And it would have a negative interest rate, which is actually the cost of storing the commodities that are backing that particular currency. Now, that would be a currency that makes it profitable to think long-term. Just imagine mobilizing the entire major multinational power into a future thinking. That is what that makes it possible. So it gives you a flavor of the scale, the range, all right, from the local neighborhood currencies that Jackie was describing to a global currency, and everything in between, by the way.
And what we're talking about in the book is we're not talking about a push, but a pull technology. You know, you just don't sit in your living room and say, gee whiz, I'm going to create my own currency in the morning. We really talk, and we give lots of examples in the books, of people coming together that are facing certain problems. Let's take about it. Everybody wakes up every morning with not what we just explained, you know, how it is we're going to take care of grandma or mother, for example. But how do we educate our children? How do we get people back working again? How do we green our cities? You know, there are so many issues, and we have so many unused resources, such as people's talents and capabilities. So communities are coming together and getting into a very deep conversation about how are we going to pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps to resolve the problems that we face. And city after city, town after town, village after village, region after region are coming together and having these very deep conversations and are resolving their problems by creating their own currencies that work in tandem with the national currencies. We're not saying that these will replace like the dollar or the euro or, you know, the yen, for example. These will work in tandem. It's like having a monetary toolbox. You know, regular money like dollars are like hammers. They're fine for when you want to hammer a nail into the wall over there. However, we need the monetary equivalents of a screwdriver, a saw, a paintbrush, because you can't paint a room with a hammer. So it's with this degree of specificity that communities can come together and design currencies that address directly their issues, their problems, their situations.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Bernard Liotard and Jackie Dunn, authors of the book Rethinking Money, How New Currencies Turn Scarcity into Prosperity. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How widespread are these cooperative or complementary currencies presently, and where are they mostly located?
In 1984, there were only two. We stopped counting in 2005, just before the crisis, and there were more than 4,000 at that point in a dozen countries. So it is really widespread. Until the 95, there was Japan that was the leading country. Today, it is Brazil. Brazil has been very innovative. The government in Brazil, for example, is currently funding the introduction of 200 dual currency banks that work in two currencies. After the successful implementation about 15 years ago of Banco Palmas in the northeast of Brazil, they tested it for 10 years and now it's being generalized.
One of the important things to keep in mind is that these are not just cute little curiosities that are happening in local villages and local towns, etc. You know, for example, Switzerland. You know, why do you think Switzerland is so economically stable? Is it something to do with the drinking water or the fact that they got wonderful Alps and or the fact they were neutral in the Second World War? No. It's actually because they have a dual currency system, and that has been the secret of their economic stability. And the story is amazing. About 80 years ago, 17 businessmen sat around a table really, really gloomy because they had all gotten notices from their banks that their lines of credit had been cut. And they were looking at each other, what are we going to do? How are we going to pay our employees? How are we going to, you know, pay for our supplies? And they then realized, looking around the table at one another, that they all bought or sold within that particular circle of 17 people. And they said, good heavens, we're going to a bank and to borrow money so we can pay one another. So they created their own currency, and it's called the WIR, W-I-R. And 80 years later, about 20% of all business in Switzerland is conducted in this complementary currency called the WIR. And there are about 65,000 businesses that actually use it as a medium of exchange.
That system has actually been proven in several peer-reviewed articles that it is the key factor, a key factor for stabilizing the Swiss economy. And the reason for that is the following. When you have a boom period, and if you give the choice to a business guy to choose to receive 1,000 WIR or 1,000 Swiss franc, he will always take the Swiss francs. Because with that, he can actually pay his taxes. He can travel to Cancun for vacation. He can buy stuff in China if he wants to. With the WIR, he has to buy among the 65,000 businesses that are part of the membership. Now, when you are in a recession period and the Swiss franc becomes scarce, then everybody accepts it. So the volume of WIR and the number of participants increases automatically when there is a recession. So it's a little bit like having a spare tire. Okay, a spare tire is a stupid idea until you have a flat on a Saturday night on a highway, right? And that is what stabilizes. Whenever there's a downturn in Switzerland, it's softened. And when there's a boom, the currency does not contribute to inflation.
What have been some of the challenges in implementing these complementary currencies?
It's mostly mental to begin with. Okay, the second thing, you need to create a community around that idea. A community of businesses for a business-to-business system, a community of a particular neighborhood if you're living in the neighborhood. Whatever the scale in which you can have a leadership pulled together, that is the scale that the currency can actually function and be implemented. So that's the first thing, regroup people. Then the next thing is, are we sure about our objective? What is the unmet need that we need to cover? What is the purpose for this? And then what are the resources available that have not been exploited yet? And that could be things like, well, first of all, idle people who are jobless. A lot of time is available, a lot of skill sets. A second thing is buildings outside of the official hours, schools, restaurant tables that are not used. Whatever these unused resources that are available, you can create then a link between these two, and that's what the currency does. Just like in the example that Jackie mentioned earlier with the frequent flyer miles, the airline industry, what has it done at the time? It has linked an unused resource, an empty seat, with what they wanted to achieve, which is customer loyalty. And that is the mechanism that they have created, and it has been working for 40 years.
And the reason why these are really cropping up now, Diane, is the fact there's a wonderful convergence of the information age, cheaper access to computing and the internet and social media. So anybody can go online and type in complementary currencies or local currencies or the WIR or whatever example they would like to look at. And they will be utterly amazed at the amount of information there's available. There's YouTube videos, for example. You can go to timedollars.org. And, you know, there's software to be downloaded. There's, you know, how-to guides. I mean, it's all there.
Would you go into a bit more detail about why our current monetary system really isn't working for us?
What we're dealing with is a monoculture. It is very efficient. The capacity for the system to process volume of dollars on a global level is totally extraordinary and unprecedented. I compare it to a pine forest. Pines is a very efficient way of having more volume of timber every year. However, it is very fragile. It doesn't have the resilience that a natural ecosystem would have. So what we're talking about is the creation, the going from a monoculture of a single currency, which has a specific agenda, by the way. It drives competition. It makes short-term thinking the profitable way of looking at the world. All these things are programmed into that currency. So by having other currencies that can actually soften or round off the excesses of the monoculture, then provides perhaps a less efficient system, economists will say, and I agree, but a lot more resilient. And that's what we're really looking for, a resilient, equitable, fair society that gives more chances for people to choose a lifestyle other than just competing like rats for a couple of crumbs of the table, which is what tends to happen now.
And to add to what Bernard's just said, there's been something like 425 crises in the last 30 years, and that's from the failure of the money system itself. Banking crashes, look what we went through in 2007, 2008. Think of a sovereign debt crisis. Look at Greece, for example. I mean, we're talking about countries all over the world where 50% of young people under the age of 25 have no work, and these are educated people. How can we possibly have democracy? How can we have sustainability without these issues being addressed? And what we say is that ordinary people are coming up with extraordinary solutions by rethinking money, and they are addressing these issues such as unemployment, taking care of the elderly, education, and our very fragile ecology.
Washington State and many other states lack the funds in our current monetary system they need to address public services and infrastructure. To what extent might cooperative currencies help address this problem?
Well, there are solutions. Could give the example of Curitiba in Brazil. We've been doing it for 25 years. You want to deal with that, Jackie?
I'd be glad to tell you that great story. It's one of my favorite stories. He always passes on to me. This really is one of my favorite stories, my little chestnut story. Jaime Lerner had a terrible problem. He was mayor of the town of Curitiba, which is in southeast Brazil, 25 years ago. And there were huge favelas, shanty towns that had grown up all over Curitiba. But he didn't have the money to level the favelas and move people out. So he had to deal with, well, what I have is a huge garbage problem because the garbage trucks could not get up the little alleyways to pick up the garbage. So there was disease, there were rats. I mean, it was a horrible mess. But still, he didn't have money to pick up the garbage. So he sent out a notice to the favelas, to all the children, that for every bag of garbage that was sorted out between, you know, cans and glass and paper, they would get a token to ride on the bus service. Lo and behold, within a matter of weeks, the favelas were picked clean and the tokens were now being used by the families to ride on the buses. And later on, these tokens were then used as a form of currency, a complementary currency to buy local produce. And one of my favorite photographs is a photograph that was taken of fishing trawlers that go out into the bay and days when the fish aren't biting, the fishermen actually bring in garbage and have it sorted out in the Curitiba garbage collection centers. What is interesting about the Curitiba story is that they, out of nothing, created a complementary currency which was using the tokens for the bus services. And if you looked at the average person who lived in Curitiba, within about a five-year period, they had a standard of living that was a third higher than anybody else living elsewhere in Brazil as a result of having a dual currency system. And we're seeing it time and time again in various communities that by rethinking money, having a dual or multiple currency system, the area actually becomes far more prosperous. So getting back to your case in point about what can cities and towns do, they can rethink money themselves and see what their unused resources are and their unmet needs. And in this case, they had the unused resource of all these great children who were ready to pick up garbage. And they had some idle capacity on the bus system. And by linking it with the tokens, they created a new currency. So we give lots of examples of lots of different cities all over the world that are able to put people to work. Some of them can actually accept partial payment of the local taxes in the complementary currency. Therefore, the local government has a way of paying their employees and keeping the currency circulating.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Bernard Leotard and Jackie Dunn, authors of the book Rethinking Money, How New Currencies Turn Scarcity into Prosperity. Have governments generally been receptive to these complementary currencies?
In the United States, there are 41 states that are currently funding someone at their own staff to start what is called time banking. There are 400 systems operational in America today. This is the most common system in America. It is a social purpose currency. It's a system that was designed initially by Edgar Kahn from Washington, D.C., and it is using the time unit, an hour, as the unit of account. And it mobilizes a community to help each other very effectively. Now, there are legal services, for example, that are accepting time dollars so that the people who receive the help give it forward further in their community. So you create a whole chain effect. And these systems are actually the only case that we currently have in America which has been declared officially tax exempt because it solves social problems that would cost a lot of taxpayer dollars otherwise, and it solves them without any further input from the government.
How could cooperative currencies work at the global level? Would you say more about that?
Sure. I mentioned the Terra system, the trade reference currency, as one example for this. This would be a currency that is nobody's national currency. Whatever the country is that plays a global currency role, which has been America since World War II, has actually have a conflict of interest in certain periods. What's good for the country is not necessarily good for the rest of the economy, or vice versa. So this currency would be independent of any country. It is supported, it's backed by a basket of commodities that are important to the global system today. And the storage cost of this is actually paid by the bearer of the currency. As a consequence, when you have such a currency, you actually will use it purely as a medium of exchange. There is a cost of keeping it as a store of value. So that's why it becomes a pure medium of exchange. This would activate the global economy automatically because there's more raw materials available when there is a recession. So there's more Terra currency being automatically issued at that period, which would activate the economy. Just like it happens in Switzerland that we mentioned earlier with the Vier, the volume of that currency increases when there is a recession and decreases when there is a boom. So it stabilizes the global system. And specifically in this case, with the Terra, the purpose really is to make it profitable to think long term. Because when you have a negative rate currency, there's a cost keeping it. When you discount the future, actually becomes more important the future than the present. The opposite of what we do with any currency that has a normal interest rate, a positive one.
So what we're talking about here is having a monetary ecoculture, which are currencies working at all different levels. So there would be something like the Terra, for example, that would be global. But we're talking about regional currencies, and a region could be defined all different kinds of ways. And we have examples of the Regiogeld in German-speaking Europe. There's about 65 different regional currencies in Germany and Austria that help regions within Germany and Austria. There are local currencies, for example, at a town level that incentivize people to shop locally and to support local businesses and services. You can have it operating on a state level, on a village level, or you can define a community as a business-to-business level, a B2B like in the Weir, for example, or you could have a community defined like old age pensioners, for example. So there's different ways of defining community. But what we're suggesting is that you have a monetary ecoculture, which means it operates from the smallest to the very, very global at all different levels. And that way, when there is a problem with national currency, such as the dollar or the euro, there's something to fall back on.
How well do other economists accept these ideas about complementary money systems?
That varies a lot, predictably. The idea that we need a single currency per country because it is more efficient dates back to Adam Smith and hasn't really been put in question at all in the theoretical framework, except by us. And I'm working with a team of people in Europe and in the States, but we are definitely not in the majority. The point is, however, that we are already in such a world. We are already outside of the monoculture. It has already happened. And just think about Miles, it has happened for 40 years. Conventional economics doesn't take that into account. It assumes them away. And we are, in fact, already outside of the box of a single currency. And what we're now talking about is how to best use these tools for actually addressing the challenges of the 21st century. And I think the challenges is actually what's going to drive the point, because conventional economics has not been able to deal with them, because that's why they are still there. Otherwise, they would have been sold a long time ago, wouldn't they?
I jokingly remark sometimes when I'm talking to Bernard is I talk about trying to resolve today's problems with today's money is like trying to do calculus using Roman numerals. It's an absolute impossibility. We're in a total change of age, so we need new money in order to address our issues.
What are the best steps that could be taken to encourage these complementary systems?
The most powerful tool that is available to government is actually the tax code. And you could very well, that's something we're proposing to do in Greece or now in Cyprus, is to have cities issue a currency and request a tax payable in only in that currency. Be aware that the currency that's chosen by government to pay taxes is automatically what gives that particular currency the power and whoever has or controls it. When it has been wheat, it was the farmers that had the power. When it was tobacco leaves in American colonial periods, it was the farmers again, the tobacco producers. When it is gold, it's the gold miners and the gold hoarders that were getting the power. And when it's electronic bits from a bank, it's the banks that get the power. So the governments can choose which currency they want to empower and automatically thereby give an inaction a series of activities that otherwise would not happen.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
There's hope. There's good news. The crisis is in fact a birth of another type of economy and another society. And the faster we actually give ourselves the tools to address these new challenges, the better and the smoother the transition will be. The choice is not whether we're going to change or not. That's already decided. We have to change. How do we do it best, equitably, smoothly, without too much upsetting everybody?
I think the really exciting news of the book and the many, many stories that we chronicle in the book is that we can have a better world, that we can enjoy ourselves that's imbued with our values, and we can pass it on to our children.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Diane.
You were just listening to Bernard Liotard and Jackie Dunn, authors of the book Rethinking Money, How New Currencies Turn Scarcity into Prosperity, published in 2013 by Barrett Kohler Publishers. For more information, check on the web at liotard.com. Again, that's liotar.com. And also rethinkingmoneythebook.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.